Hey y'all, this is Cold Cases, Cults, Murders, Oh My, and I'm your host, Pamela Pamela, with my dog, Sam. And today, well, we're going to talk about a really crazy case. But before we get into that, I do want to talk about a couple of things. One, I want to apologize for missing last week. Work was crazy, but right now, I seem to have a lot of time on my hands. So there you go. But on a more serious note, I do want to say we have a missing person this week, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, what we know, what he was last seen wearing, those kinds of things, give you some police numbers, Crime Stoppers, just so if you know something, please come forward. Somebody knows something, and his family would be very appreciative if you could come forward. So, there is a young man in Tyler, Texas, missing. His name is Harley Morris. He is 29 years old. He was last seen around 3 a.m. on January 21st, 2024. He was seen exiting a local nightclub called 50 Grand Club. He was last seen wearing a 102 Prime hat. This is a local restaurant, the 102 Prime. That's a restaurant. So he was also seen in a gray hoodie and had on black shoes. If anyone knows anything, please call the Tyler Police Department at 903-531-1000. Or you can call Crime Stoppers at 903-597-2833. They are asking for people and businesses that live and work in the area around the north of Gentry Parkway and North Loop 323. If you have a doorbell camera or some sort of surveillance on your business, if you could check your cameras and see if you see anyone walking around in this time frame, they would be very grateful. So, if you know anything, just please come forward. His family is missing him, and I know that they're offering a reward, and I'm gonna post the link where I got the information about him from in the show notes. So be sure and look at that. And if you have a camera and you saw somebody walking, it would have been after 3 a.m. on the 21st. Please look at it, see if you see anything. And if you do, call the cops and let them know. They would be very appreciative. So with that being said, we're gonna jump into this case. So this is going to be a two-parter. Because, well, I mean, I started it and then like it just kept growing. And so I have like 23 pages of research. And yeah, so I don't think you want to sit here and listen to, you know, a 2-hour episode. So I'm breaking it up into two parts. So I do want to give a trigger warning here at the beginning. I will also give a warning again before I get to the parts of the case this week. So I believe in the first part, there's no actual murder. But there are some other things. So I'll give you a trigger warning before I say, you know, whatever happened. And I do want to say that this is one of the worst cases that I've ever researched. It does involve rape and murder of 27 teenagers. There is also mention of animal cruelty. So, like, in the first half, I think it just talks about animal, like, things that are in animal cruelty. So, I'll put in the warning there. And then when we get to part two, it's mostly about the murders and, like, what happened. So, I will again put in the trigger warnings for that episode as well. I will not go into really graphic details for that information. It is available online. If you want to know it, then you'll have the articles that I looked at. And so you can go look it up on there. There's just, it's very gruesome, and I don't really want to be talking about that kind of stuff. So it's also important to remember that the true count of victims may never be known on this case. So we do know that there were definitely 27 victims of Dean Corll. However, we may never know the true number because, well, the reason we know the 27 is he had accomplices who talked about what happened. So that's why we have that information. However, they do believe that he was killing well before he got these two accomplices. It's also important to remember any information we have on Dean Corll. Well, it's from his mom. And so, you know, he was a big mama's boy. And so, you know, she's going to paint him in the best light possible. And she still thinks that, you know, he's innocent. So, yeah, take her account of things with a grain of salt because, you know, mama's not ratting out her kid. But let me tell you something. I've told my child that if he ever murders somebody, he better know that, yeah, I'm not backing him up in the media if I know that he's a murderer. So I will call the police on him. Anyways, so let's get started. On August 8th, 1973, the police were called out to a shooting in Pasadena, Texas, a subdivision just outside of Houston at the time. I say at the time because Houston has grown so much that it may or may not still be a subdivision. So they arrived to find a dead man on the ground. He had been shot 3 times in the chest. Well, actually, it was shoulder. And 3 times in the back. A 17-year-old teenager named Elmer Wayne Henley had shot him. If the police thought this would be a simple open and shut case, they had no clue what horrific nightmare this young man was about to take them on. It would lead to the discovery of 27 victims, although some reports say they found 28 or 29 victims. We're going to go with what the Texas Monthly said, and they said that there was 27. Not being picky, just saying that, you know, the Texas Monthly is pretty reputable, and I know a lot about that magazine, not so much about other sources. So these victims would range in age from 13 to the oldest being a 20-year-old college student. The victims were all male. They were all from the Heights neighborhood or within a few blocks of the neighborhood, except for the college student. He was just hitchhiking, but we'll get into that later. You would think that someone would have put two and two together, but I mean, I'm guessing that it's like, I mean, 27 boys are missing and they still don't think it. Anything of it. Honestly, I think that if Henley had not shot and killed Dean Corll, there would have been even more known missing boys. There probably would also have been bodies that were never found, and if they did find them, if it weren't for Henley, they wouldn't know who had done it. So when the police got there, like, they were talking to Henley and, you know, he was kind of like walking them through what had just happened. And then he proceeded to, you know, spill his guts, so to speak. So let's get this story started with the douchebag of the century, Dean Arnold Corll. Corll was the first born son of Mary and Arnold Corll. He was born on December 24th, 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The couple would go on to have another son a little later. The father was strict with the boys, but he was never violent. But they knew when they'd done something wrong. So, like, you know, some people have those parents who just, like, look at them and know. Or I'm pretty sure it was more like, you didn't clean your room, now you're going to lose, like, all your privileges. I would have given an example of a privilege, but I was not born in 1939, so I don't really know what you're taking away from your kid at that time. Now, unlike their father, their mother would pamper them, and she was very protective of her boys. So the marriage was rocky, and 4 years after the youngest son was born, the marriage ended in divorce in 1946. This is also the time that Arnold, the father, he was drafted to serve in the military, and he was stationed in Tennessee. Now, I'm not really sure, like, I don't know that they were still drafting people after World War II, but, I mean, the article I read did say that he was drafted, so I guess maybe. I don't know what they were drafting for, but, you know, 40s. So, you know, what did Mary do, you know, once the divorce was over and, you know, she could pretty much do anything she wanted? Well, of course, she did the only sensible thing there was to do. She sold the home in Indiana and moved to Memphis, Tennessee to be near, you guessed it, the ex-husband. But she said that it was so the boys could be closer to their father. But don't you worry. Their love story, well, it's not quite over yet. So, as Cruel started school, it was observed that he was shy and withdrawn from other children. And in part, it was probably because he was sick a lot and the other children would pick on him. So, I mean, who wants to be friends with a bully? However, what was causing him to be sick would not be diagnosed until 1950. When they learned that Coral had a heart murmur. So the answer to this, you know, problem that Coral had was to write him a note to get him out of gym. Because, you know, gym does not do a heart murmur good. I don't really know. I mean, maybe they didn't know how to treat a heart murmur in the 50s. I don't really know when that technology, like, evolved. I mean, I don't even know what the treatment for one is now, but I know that they do have a treatment, and, like, they do more than give out a note saying you don't have to be at gym. So we do have to remember, you know, it was the 1950s. So, you know, that kind of explains a lot. Anyways, as tragedy often does, this would bring Mary and Arnold back together, and they would get remarried in 1950. Isn't that adorable? Because who doesn't want to marry their ex-husband again? But we all saw that coming. Tragedy or not, the woman moved to be closer to him after the divorce. So, I mean, we kind of saw it coming. Maybe you didn't, but I did. At this time, they thought, hey, let's move to, I don't know, the hottest place on Earth, Texas. I mean, it's not really the hottest place on Earth, but I mean, it's a close second to, like, any other hot place. I mean, they did move to Pasadena, Texas, just outside of Houston at this time. However, it seemed that, well, history was going to repeat itself when it comes to Arnold and Mary there and their love story. It was over before you knew it. The couple was divorced again in 1953. I also want to point out that back then, it was a lot harder to get a divorce. It was not like today where you go in and say, yeah, I don't really like him, so we need a divorce. Or, yeah, we were drunk when we got married. And, well, I like the drunk version of him better than the sober version. you know, that's just some examples of today versus back in the day where you had to prove that either he was being abusive or that he was cheating on you on someone else, or that one of you had abandoned the other. So keep that in mind whenever we talk about Mary and her many wives, because she's not going to stop getting married anytime soon. After this divorce, Mary got the children, but they did stay in contact with their father. Now, after the divorce, Mary would go on to marry a guy by the name of Jake West. Doesn't he just sound like the best? Well, he was a traveling clock salesman. I mean, what? Mary's just, you know, she's just out here wild and like, I'll take any guy that walks on two legs. I mean, how do you even date and marry a traveling salesman, let alone a clock one? I'm just saying. He had to be super boring, but whatever. Like, he shows up at your door and you're like, no thanks on the clock, but hey, let's go out on a date. What? No. Anyways, once married, the family moved to Vidor, Texas, and Mary and Jake would have a daughter in 1955. I just want to point out that Mary, she is not a slow mover here. If you'll remember, she just got divorced like 2 years before. I mean, I'm starting to think Mary is one of those people that can't live without a man, but she also can't live with a man either. So Mary and Jake decide to open up a candy shop in their garage. So yeah, you heard me right. A candy shop in their garage. I mean, how bonkers is that? You know, one place I would never buy candy from is someone's garage. But I mean, I guess you do you. Coral and his younger brother would work in the candy shop day and night, even while going to school. Guess it was a good thing Coral wasn't into having friends. The two boys would run the candy making machine and also pack the candies. Sounds like they were doing most of the work. I mean, like, what was mom, like, I don't know, stirring the candy, maybe? I don't really know what mom was doing. She was out there being crazy. Then once packaged, Jake would sell candy while he was traveling for work. Also, Mary, I just want to question, if you found this guy while he's selling clocks, who's to say he's not finding somebody else while selling clocks? I'm just saying, gotta use your noggin sometimes, which she's not good at. Anyway, so like while he's out traveling, you know, he's giving out these candies, and most of the candy was going to locations in Houston that he would stop and try to sell, you know, a clock to. So while in school, Coral would be known as a good kid, a bit of a loner. When in high school, he would take up playing in a brass band, and he liked to play the trombone. I mean, I'm just saying, guys. I mean, I was in the band. I played a flute. But, I mean, I did have some friends. Unlike, you know, Dean over here, who's, I don't know what the heck he's doing, playing a trombone. What was he thinking? But, hey, he's just doing him. So, some other fun facts about his childhood. One being that at the age of 10, good old Mommy Dearest over there, yeah, she thought that, you know, sending the boys off to their grandmother's house for the summer, which is totally okay, by the way. But, yeah, I don't know what Mary was thinking, but, whew, Mary. So, like, they ended up going out, to the grandmother's house, and, you know, the mom's like, well, they went out in the middle of summer because, well, there were some people picking on old Deanie here, and we don't want that. She also pointed out that, again, remember, age 10, that it was a great idea and a great time for them to get their sexual education while on the farm. Now, I'm not really sure how much younger Dean's brother is than he is, but let's do keep in mind that he is, in fact, younger. Because, I mean, what could possibly go wrong here? Because these would be her words. I mean, what questions could one possibly have after watching the livestock bump uglies? The answer, he was 10. So I would guess so many questions. In fact, the fact that Mary thought it was appropriate to say this, well, that's just crazy. I mean, like, you're sitting down for an interview and then you're like, hey, yeah, so, you know, when Dean was, I don't know, 10 years old, yeah, well, I sent him off to this farm so that he could watch the livestock there bump uglies and, you know, figure out all the questions or all the things he needed to know about sex. Probably not, Mary. Probably not. Then I just want to say, I don't know what the heck young boys and teens did back in the 50s for fun, but, well, trigger warning here. There's going to be some discussion of animal cruelty for a second. So, what did they do for fun in the 50s? Well, according to some articles, they set cats on fire. That was an option. I mean, what were you doing back in the 50s? I don't know. Then the next option, not much better. I'm just saying. So this could also be like one reason that Dean didn't have a lot of friends. I mean, I'm just going to throw this out here. I could totally be wrong. I mean, they were setting cats on fire, so I don't know. But the reason could be that he was trying to single-handedly take out the flying squirrel population in Vidor, Texas. He would torture and kill them, and then he would sometimes make necklaces out of them. Like, dude, Dean, you have no friends because you're walking around with a whole freaking dead squirrel around your neck. Hello, who wants to be friends with that? I mean, that's disgusting on so many levels. But, I mean, Vidor, Texas was wild, wild, wild back in the 50s. I mean, whew, glad I wasn't there. And also the next question I would have to say is, where are your parents, sir, letting you walk around with a dead squirrel around your neck? What? But, I mean, he would manage to get all right grades in high school. There you go. I mean, that is the next thing that you know that we're going to talk about is like, yeah, he was walking around with a dead squirrel on his neck, but hey, he got good grades. I mean, they were all right. So he would also, you know, date a girl here and there while he was in high school. And again, I say, who in their right mind is dating a dude that's wearing a squirrel around his neck? I mean, let me give all you single ladies some dating advice. If you meet a man with a dead squirrel around his neck, that's like a whole freaking army of red flags. Just throwing that out there. Sorry, I just can't get over the fact that, you know, he had a dead animal on his person. But, so Dean, he did graduate in 1958, and his family was on the move again. This time, they moved to the outskirts of Houston, to be closer to where most of their candy was being sold. So they mostly sold pecan pralines, which are very yummy, if you don't know what they are. They are delicious, because, you know, Mary, she was being a bad boss, and she had purchased a recipe for $10 on how to make these pecan pralines. Again, what? Why are people selling recipes? Just go to church, ask some old lady how she makes them. It's free. That way. I mean, I wasn't alive back then, but it seems strange that she would like buy a recipe unless like, so the article that I read said that she bought the recipe, not that she bought a recipe book. Like that would make more sense. But I'm just saying $10 was a lot back in the day. And especially when you could just, you know, go to church and like be like, hey, how'd you make those? But maybe she was afraid she was going to like spontaneously combust if she went to church. I don't know. Anyways, the family would open up a candy factory there called the Pecan Prince, because this is what their product was called. So they're just like, okay, well, we're just gonna slap this name here on there. It was not original, people. It was just, you know, simple and plain. So during this time, Dean's mother would ask him to move to Indiana to look after his dying grandmother. You know, the one where he learned everything he needed to know about sex. Yeah, that grandmother. During his time there, he met and dated a girl. Well, at least that's what the girl thought they were doing. Dean, not so much. He would move back to Texas in 1962 after 2 years in Indiana. He was back helping with the candy factory again. And, you know, he would still write and call this girl. But, you know, he wasn't quite as invested as she was, as we're fixing to see. So one day in 1962, during one of the phone calls with this girl, she told Dean that she was getting married. And he was like, okay. And she asked him, didn't he want to know who she was marrying? He was like, I mean, not really, but I'll bite. Sure. Who you getting married to? And she said, you. I'm getting married to you. So this was her idea of a great proposal. I mean, Dean told her, yeah, that's not going to happen. We're just pals. Then he hung up the phone and he never called or wrote her again. I mean, like, ghosting back in the 60s. Whew. It was probably a lot easier to ghost people back in the 60s because, I mean, hello, you just don't call them or write them. So, I mean, there's that. What a great guy he was. Not. By the time he got back to Houston, the candy factory had moved into Houston Heights area. Coral would get a place right above the factory. And in 1963, Mary and Jake were not doing great. They were fighting over the business and, well, just, you know, married life. Well, they ended up getting a divorce that year, making it divorce number 3. But who's counting? The state of Texas, probably, because you can only marry, like, and get divorced 7 times and still live in the state of Texas. So I'm just saying, somebody was counting. But also, how would they enforce that law? I mean, are they just, like, do they have people's names on a whiteboard back then and just, like, checking off names? Like, this is her 3rd divorce. Who knows? Sorry, squirrel. In my head, like running away with me, thinking about how they figured out how this happened. Anyways, Mary being the one who started the company, would not let a little divorce end her career. She would open a candy shop across the street from her ex-husband called the Coral Candy Company. On his packaging, he would write the original Pecan Praline, to which Mary started writing on her packages, the Pecan Praline made with a woman's touch. At this time, you know, Dean, he got kind of paranoid that Jake was like sending his employees over to steal their ingredients and So he started recording everything that went on and also went so far as to tap the phones. I mean, this man really has a lot of time on his hands. He took his job way too seriously. So they also hired a bunch of teenagers to come work for their new company. One of the teenagers went to Dean's mom and told her that Dean had tried to make sexual advances towards her. And what do you think was Mary's response to that kid? Well, if you guessed talking to Dean and getting rid of him, you would be wrong. She told the boy that he was lying, and then she fired him. But it was not long before the military came knocking at the Coral family's door again. This time, it was 1963, and it was for Dean himself. He would learn how to repair radios for the Army before being sent back to Fort Hood in Texas. So he was like, I believe he was either in Louisiana or Mississippi when he learned how to like fix the radios. And then they obviously sent him back to Fort Hood so that, you know, he's in his state with his mama. So it was reported that he was really great at what he did. Like, he was super good. But we all know that he's a mama's boy and he hated it and wanted to go home. So he's like, yeah, I may be good at this, but I miss my mama. So he applied for a hardship based on the grounds that his mommy needed him back home to help run the family business. He was granted the hardship and was honorably discharged. I also want to point out that I know that y'all don't know exactly what he did just yet, but yeah, this piece of scum got a military funeral, which, I mean, when you hear what he did, you might be just as disappointed as I was. So he was discharged in 1964. He had only served 10 months in the Army. He told some of his acquaintances that while in the service, he had his first male relationship. They also noticed that when he came back, that he tended to like spending most of his time with younger teenage males. Just want to point out that he was doing the same thing before he left. I mean, it may not have been as prominent as it was when he got back, but I mean, the kid did go tell his mom, you know, before he left for the military. So it's not that it just popped up out of the blue once he got back, but they would go on to move the Coral Candy Company because the competition, well, between the two, it was just getting too fierce. So somebody had to move. So, of course, it's, you know, bad boss Mary. And you know what? Where would they move the new candy company to? Well, of course, right across from an elementary school. I mean, way to target your demographic, but also feeding into Dean's growing need for teenage boys. Maybe not the best idea. So Dean would stand outside when the kids got out of school and hand out candy. Of course, none of the parents or staff thought anything of it. They just thought, oh, this is just a nice man giving out candy. They all just started calling him the Candy Man, hence the name of this episode. Today, we would be suspicious, but we would also call what he did grooming. So, I mean, we have made some advances, you know. He would later turn a spot in the candy factory into a playroom where he had, you know, a pool table that everybody could come hang out at. Occasionally, he had some drugs and some alcohol. So, you know, like everybody's hanging out there because it's the 60s. And who doesn't want drugs in the 60s? So before he knew it, the place was crawling with teenage workers at the candy company. So once they started hanging out there, then he started making these jobs available to these kids. And so they're all like, yay, a job and drugs. Life is good. And one of the teens that would be part of this group was a teenager by the name of David Brooks. Sadly, he would later go on to be one of the accomplices of Dean's. But before we get there, David would hang out with Dean and some of the other kids. He would also go on some of the trips that Dean would take with some of the teenagers to the beach. I'm just saying, people, I feel like it's weird that just some random dude is taking your kid to the beach. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't weird back then, but I feel like it was. Just saying. So David had a rough childhood. Dean would become the only father figure that David would know, but not too long after, like, they started hanging out all the time together, he would also become the first victim that we know of Dean Quarles. He would later say that the kids and teachers would make fun of him for glasses and that Coral was the only person that would not. And I just say, man, teachers were cruel back in the day, making fun of kids for their glasses. Like, he can't help that. That's not his fault. Okay. So, trigger warning here. You may want to skip ahead a few minutes. Probably not even that long, but just saying. That is if you don't want to hear about the sexual abuse of David. So, David would ask Coral for money, and he would give it to him. However, over time, Dean told him that he would pay him $20 if David would let him give. This is going to sound confusing, so let me try to figure out a better way to say this. Dean would give him $20 if David would let Dean give him a blowjob. Later, he would offer $200 if David would bring him boys to torture and kill. But we're not there yet. So David's parents were getting a divorce, and David moved with his mom 85 miles away from Houston. So you're thinking, thank goodness, yay. But since I've already told you that, you know, he was an accomplice, you also know that he obviously comes back. So he would occasionally come back to visit, like, his dad, who was still in the area where Dean was. And so when he would come see his dad, he would also go see Dean. He would end up moving back to Houston. He would drop out of school. And he would later say that Dean's apartment was like his second home. By the time that David had dropped out of school, Dean's mother had moved or was in the process of moving to Colorado because, believe it or not, she had gotten married again before she moved. And, well, the guy's real name isn't known. Like, I think they call him like Ricky or something in like some other articles, but he isn't really, like, his name is not known. And it sounds like it was a very volatile relationship with the husband. You know, he was talking about how he would kill and dispose of Mary's body but then he would turn around and he'd be just like, I'm just kidding. So, like, he was aggressive, and then, you know, he would go through his honeymoon stage. But, yeah, Mary, she wasn't taking no chances. So, she ended up with divorce number 4, and then Mary went to a psychic, and the psychic told her she needed to move to Colorado because if she didn't, her ex-husband was going to kill her. So she closed up the candy shop in 1968 and took her daughter and moved to Colorado. To everyone's shock, Dean did not follow her there. He chose to stay behind in Texas. Even though Mary would talk to her son on the phone a lot, she would never see Dean alive again. Once the candy company had closed their doors for good, Dean would go to work for the electric company in Houston, where he tested electrical relay systems. He would have this job until he died. So we're going to stop there for today. And we will obviously finish it up. I may release the episode before next week. I may not release the episode before next week. We'll just have to, you know, wait and see what happens. But I do want to remind you of what I said at the beginning of the podcast with the missing guy whose name is Harley Morris. He is 29 years old. And he went missing on January 21st, 2024. And I apologize for my aggressive dog barking, if you can hear that. And I think that's all I have. Next week, or part two, whichever way I decide to release that, we will be getting into the actual murders of the boys that Dean took the lives of. He has two accomplices. You've obviously met one, that being David Brooks. So I hope that you will come back next week or whenever I release this episode, the second episode. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of your week and remember to be kind to others. You never know what battle they're fighting. And thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like us on whatever platform you listen on. And, well, I'll see you next time. Bye.